The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Today, teams from the Mersey say merci and show no mercy. Everton do the Gunners at Goodison. Podars is the manager with the Premier League's worst eyesight, no longer Arsenal's man of vision, while Liverpool march on through the storm as Rodgers has his hammers down. There's all the Premier League news, dismissal for Chris Hughton at Norwich, while that missile from Kieran Richardson at Villa Park sees Norwich's next rivals Fulham dreaming of another great escape. We take a look at the midweek Champions League games and we round up all the rest of the continent's sackings. Chiellino's been added again and it's the finish for Sami Hyypiä at Leverkusen. All of that plus lots more in the odd post or two as well in this Football Weekly. Wow. So feeling a great responsibility about today's pod because there's so many big things to be discussed. Matters of huge importance and that. Luckily, we've got Raphael Honigstein here. Hi, Rafa.
Hello, good morning.
And Greg Bukowski.
Hi, James.
And, boom, Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Did you enjoy Sunday?
Yes.
It was the day when Everton played Arsenal and Liverpool were at West Ham.
Yes, it was.
All right. Well, let's start off today's show with Everton-Arsenal because it feels like something big happened there, Rafa. Something big.
Yeah. It could yet not be big because Arsenal's running is fairly kind to them and they tend to do very well against the teams who don't play football.
Like when they play Swansea. Oh, when they don't play football. Sorry, yeah.
Too quick on the draw.
Yeah, leaping in there.
But Everton have given themselves an amazing chance. I think also is a real coming-of-age performance for the team, for Roberto Martinez, who I think has now convinced the last few doubters that might still have been around in this country that he is the genuine real deal. And the same, I'm not sure, can still be said about his opposite number.
Mm. Well, the situation now, they're one behind Arsenal, but with a game in hand. They've had six straight wins. They do have Man City and Man United to come to Goodison, but on the basis of this weekend's performance, well, you would back them heavily to take that fourth spot, and they deserve it, no?
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't? No. I say you would, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. Why not? Just because of the running?
I wouldn't back anyone heavily to beat Manchester City for a start,
right.
And Arsenal have a much easier run-in, as Raphael has already said. I mean, which is not to take away from the performance against Arsenal, but I think you have to factor in just how bad Arsenal were. Their performance was astonishing. Every single big test they've had away from home this season, they failed miserably, and this was the latest in a long line. I must confess, I thought they'd win it pretty easily, and was baffled by how poor they were. Mm. Leighton Baines was able to do whatever he wanted in the first half. Lukaku was sort of over the other side running amok. And when you've got Stephen Naismith, and no disrespect to him, but he's not a particularly brilliant player, putting in a man-of-the-match performance in the centre, you're going, what the hell are Arsenal doing?
Yeah, Morales looked impressive as well.
Yeah, it's another occasion where Wenger's been exposed as being a bit more rigid than people probably thought he was. I mean, years ago, he's obviously always been thought of as a progressive manager over here because he came in and changed the way, you know, football's seemingly played. And you looked at the match yesterday and Martinez played Lukaku a bit wider, and just doing that in itself completely baffled Arsenal's defence. And what did Wenger do about it? Not much. And that's been the case in the other games when they've gone away at teams this season. You know, there's been things he could have done, he could have changed things, and he's kind of just said, well, this is the way my Arsenal team play, and just left them to get on with it, and they've kind of, you know, they've wilted out there. Yeah. That happened yesterday. I thought Everton were really good again, and they're so strong in that midfield area. I mean, they've obviously Lukaku's been great up front, but I mean, Gareth Barry and McCarthy as the kind of two holding players they've been like the platform from, you know, for a lot of the good play to be built on this season. And in front, they've got so many options like De La Feu, Osman, to be able to bring Barkley on. You know, that's what a treat that is.
Mm, absolutely,
they're so strong.
So Arsenal's intransigence is partly to blame for this, but also the Frenchman darkly hinting that his team might not be up for the fight. That they
They don't have the right kind of attitude, Rafa.
It's always about psychology for him. Every single defeat is, for him, down to mentality, mental handbrakes, fear, nerves. That's the only explanation he ever comes up with. And I don't think anyone's buying it anymore, because it's just another very convenient way to shift the discussion into an area where nobody can really argue with him. Because if he says the team is nervous, you know, how can you argue with that? But I think there are much more banal reasons to do with tactics, with setting your team up, with being adaptive to the opposition, that he's just not bothered with. And these are much more, in my view, decisive factors when it comes losing against the top teams. There's a real pattern there, and it's been established over the last few years, and this season it was very clear again. And when they fail to beat Man City after failing to beat Man United and Chelsea at home, very similar performances. It's the third time he said we were nervous in the first half. But you just wonder, you know, what top team in any European division can you think of where the manager continually says, my team was nervous?
What's that do to the players as well, if they're constantly hearing that? They're, you know, they're constantly hearing their own manager kind of call them out on their own mental fragility.
I think it was a valid excuse when he was playing the youngsters 5-6 years ago, when he had a team that was really, really young, and you could say, okay, they're all a little bit inexperienced, and when they come up against bigger, more experienced sides, they can be bullied a bit. But this team is not young. I think the youngest starter was probably 25 in that game.
Would you agree, though, Bernal, that maybe that Everton just did look more bothered for this clash for the top four?
Oh, absolutely. And as I've said before, I hope they get the fourth spot, because I think Arsenal have stagnated to such an extent now that finishing outside the top four would possibly be a very good kick up the backside for them to get. And because there's no doubt complacency has set in there, I think. I mean, you could argue in their defence, fourth place, considering the amount of money they spend, is probably about par, and they have players out through injury, you know, Wilshire, Walcott, Ozil, Ramsey was out for a while, and so they have had setbacks, but their performances against the teams above and immediately beneath them away from home just haven't been good enough at all, and should be a lot better.
Many people as well would suggest that the paucity of the alternatives for Wenger is entirely his own fault through lack of activity on the transfer window.
Not underestimate what this means for Everton as well, because if they got into the top four, then, I mean, they're a club that haven't been able to generate that much money, and they would really be they'd really benefit from the money that the Champions League could bring in, and particularly with Martinez having to rely on loan signings who, you know, may go elsewhere. He might be able to keep Lukaku, he might be able to then.
Do you think he would?
Well, if you get into the Champions League, then they could possibly afford him then. I'm not sure they could do if they didn't get into the Champions League. And they also need to, you know, try and convince players of the quality of De La Feu to come to them, you know, and kind of, because that's the kind of quality player they've had this season.
Absolutely.
Greg, on Merseyside, how is Ken Wright viewed by Everton fans? Because he's always seemed quite unpopular, and to me he seems like a brilliant owner.
Well, I think Everton fans respect what he's done for the club. I think when they now it's easier for them to be kind of warmer towards him, because the club's doing well. They've got in a very good manager, but they were always seeing other clubs around them kind of, you know, having owners come in who've got loads of money to spend and elevate other clubs, like City, for instance. Everton and City were both two similar clubs in that they were seen as the second teams in their cities for a long time, and, you know, they saw City get all this money, and it kind of, there's a jealousy there. But I think this is why now there's been progress at the club through, you know, a good appointment of a manager, and they're not in trouble like a club like Leeds, whereas they've overspent to try and elevate the club, and I think he's managed them as well as he could do. So
I also think it's been no secret that the club's been up for sale for many many years, and if they were to get into the Champions League, be a much more interesting proposition for anyone who wanted to invest. But of course the big problem that they have is the stadium, and I think everyone knows that taking over the club will only makes sense if you build a new stadium, which comes with huge, or renovate the old stadium, which comes with huge expenses.
All right, well, as regards Arsenal, the Chris Hughton sacking brought that stat out again about the longevity of managers, or lack of it, in the Premier League, and the fact that indeed Arsene Wenger has on his own managed for almost as long as the entire other 19 clubs' bosses put together. But is it now, are we reaching the tipping point where that's no longer going to be true for next year? Are we not going to be able to use that stat anymore? What I'm saying, Barry, is do you think he's finally going to go?
I wouldn't be surprised, and I think it might be the right move for him. I don't see how Arsenal are going to move forward. You know, they may not necessarily move backwards with if he stays, but if he leaves, they could possibly improve under a new manager. They could also
like
get
Everton did under Martinez.
Or they could get a lot worse. But that I think that's now reached. It's reached a point I think where that's a gamble a lot of Arsenal fans will be prepared to take.
Do you think there's any sign that they'll be better under him next season than they have been this year? Or has the tendency been the opposite?
I think there needs to be some serious changes within the club for them to improve. I think you need somebody who will take on the role as a sporting director independently of him, who'll go out and buy players, who's not going to start haggling about 1 or 2 million either way in January and make the signings that the team need. I think also you need probably some different setup in the coaching. I mean, maybe give more responsibility to Steve Bould, who is, I think, doing a good job by all accounts, but is only allowed very limited time with the team to work with them. I still think there is a way where they can sell it as a big sort of reboot.
But he would never work under a sporting director, though, surely, after being there as long as he has and, you know, having the, you know, the authority he has at the club. I just don't see... I just imagine something that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think he's very, very smart. And if he senses that this is the club's condition, I still think there are very few jobs that can be as comfortable and as well paid as this one. You'll still have a lot of control. It just needs a little bit less control, because if you spend your January window buying Kjell Karlstrom, then there's something very, very wrong in this club. And I think that people are beginning to wake up to that.
Right. What do you think is going to happen then? Do you think he'll still be there next season in the current setup?
Current setup, no. Mm-hmm. But I still think he's going to be there next season.
Greg, have we reached a turning point?
Yeah, I don't think he'll be there next season. I just think this season's been such a blow. 9 games ago, they went to Anfield at the top of the table. And now look where they are. I mean, the amount of goals they've shipped. I just think it's been such a blow for Wenger and his philosophy at the club. And, you know, I also think there's so many Arsenal fans who don't voice it, who just want to see a change, because, you know, you've had a manager there who's been there for so long, and things could get worse before they get better, but they just want to see something different.
The Piers Morgans of this world.
Yeah.
Barry?
I mean, it's crossed my mind that the Piers Morgans and less other less well-known but equally abusive supporters may... Just Wenger may be sick of them too, you know, and he may fancy a change away from them, because when Arsenal perform below par, he gets a lot of abuse, which I think he doesn't deserve, and he may go elsewhere. I think a lot will depend on whether or not Arsenal win the FA Cup.
Didn't we just suggest that he kind of does deserve the abuse?
He deserves criticism. He doesn't deserve abuse.
Yeah, not abuse.
Oh,
there's
not
a very
abuse. All right.
Big
okay.
difference.
Well, it wasn't long ago that he was being linked with the likes of the PSG job. I wonder what jobs he would be linked with in the current climate.
I would have thought he'd be suited to international management at this stage in his career. Have a season off and then maybe have a look at what international... even after the World Cup. You know, there'd be lots of jobs available then.
All right. Now, they could, of course, still win the FA Cup. They've got Wigan... next up, we can talk about that on Thursday then, eh? So let's move on, because other big things have been happening. And on Sunday, in the other side of that Liverpool-London axis, there was Liverpool's trip to West Ham. Greg, I imagine you followed this with some interest.
I did, yes. I followed it with a good bit to drink as well. 9 league wins on the bounce, an extraordinary run, and Liverpool won... and they won ugly yesterday, which was another kind of, you know, thing to tick off the sheet of things you need to do in a title winning season, which they did again. It was never going to be an easy game going to West Ham and, you know, playing against Big Sam's tactics. West Ham didn't need to win the game, so they were going to play with a very deep defensive line, and that's what it proved. And I think Liverpool weren't as effective going forward yesterday because there wasn't the space in behind the defence in front of them. But I thought they deserved to win the game. I thought the two penalties were penalties, the second one as well.
West Ham's equaliser.
They showed a good bit of the character that is now in the side to come back after that, because that was a big blow. I mean, a big blow on Mignolet's head from Carroll's hand as much as
although there are people who suggest that it was actually Skrtel who pushed Carroll into Mignolet. So
really,
who are these people?
People.
It's some kind of people who've watched the replay more times than I have.
Yeah, no, I could see it was a foul. I mean, things happen.
Well, the linesman could, but that was extraordinary. If the linesman saw that it was a foul, what was the conversation that he had with the referee that led to the goal then standing?
Something along the lines of, "Was there a foul? Yes. Okay, I'm going to give the goal anyway." I honestly don't know. I mean, it seems strange to go and consult the linesman. Maybe the linesman bottled it in the amount of time it took for the referee to get over, and then doubted himself and said, "You know what? I think I saw a foul. I'm not sure."
Right.
Yeah.
Ideally, you know, in a modern day televised sport, those kind of conversations would be part of the soundtrack. The refs mic'd up. I think we deserve to hear.
It's probably hard enough to recruit referees anyway.
I think that would actually attract not necessarily the right kind of referee, but referees anyway. But all added to the flavor.
I don't think the kind of language used on the football field is particularly lends itself to live broadcast
by referees.
Television. No, I meant by players whose polite requests for revisionist views might be picked up on the mic.
Charlie Adam, for example.
I'm saying basically
very choice language. In there,
won't someone think of the children?
Right, indeed, because they certainly don't use language like that.
No, God, no. But Anthony Taylor has not been particularly good referee this season, I think. And I know Jonathan Wilson was extremely critical of him yesterday. But these things happen, don't they? And there's a suggestion also that he sort of realised his mistake and then gave Liverpool a penalty anyway, which I don't believe, because I think both penalties were fair enough.
All right, and both well taken by that man, Stevie G.
Yeah.
You've had your doubts about Stevie in the past, Craig.
I have, as a deep line player, midfielder. I didn't think he would be able to kind of adapt as well as he has done, and I think partly that is to do with Brendan Rodgers making it possible for him by not, you know, he learnt not to play him in a two-man midfield and have him as the deep-line midfielder, and I think having Henderson's energy just in front of him has really helped. But I think in himself, I think Gerrard has really, really taken to the role very well, and he's been more disciplined. I actually think Liverpool have been a better attacking team this season because Gerrard's been deeper, and I think Rodgers has not wanted Gerrard to be in the eye line of a lot of the attacking players so they can express themselves and not be looking to Gerrard all the time. And I think players like Sterling particularly and Coutinho have really blossomed this season because Gerrard has been behind them and not kind of getting in the way and the person that they look to pass the ball to all the time. I think he's been a good move put him there in the end.
I'd agree, and I'd say there's also just simply more space to run into. If Gerrard doesn't occupy that number 10 space, but there's a lot deep, and I think the way that Liverpool creates space for themselves, for their attacking players, is one of the keys to their success.
All right, well, they're going to be attempting that, of course, next up against City, who themselves coming off a big win, 4-1 against Southampton, again refereeing controversy here. A lot of the Liverpool players mentioning, and Brendan Rodgers himself, their recent form against City. I mean, they lost in the game at the Etihad, but they gave arguably the Manchester side one of their toughest tests, and were Vincent unfortunate.
Vincent Kompany said that Liverpool have been the best side he's played against this season there, and they've been beaten by Chelsea there as well, and Bayern and Barcelona. I don't know if he was counting that or whether it was just the league team.
True.
I think everything is set up for it to be an absolutely incredible game at Anfield in terms of both teams just going out there and attacking each other, and the likelihood is that the team that comes out of it will be seen as the favourites for the title. I could see it being a real ding-dong battle and not something that's going to fall flat.
You're going to be there, aren't you, Greg?
I am going to be there, I'm going to be a little bit excited.
Wow. Brendan Rodgers has sort of been clever as well. He's come out and said that all the pressure is on City, because they've invested heavily to win the championship and the Champions League, and Liverpool have just gone out to enjoy themselves, you know, which is a bit disingenuous because Liverpool has spent a hell of a lot of money and they're owned by a very sophisticated and ambitious American sports investment group, so they're not exactly the church mice he's letting on.
Although there's going to be pressure. Can you imagine being Stevie G Saturday morning? This is your chance. This is one shot, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the fans are viewing it probably as Steven Gerrard is, that in that it's been, oh, this is a good season, this is a good season. Wow, what a great season we're having. And fucking hell, where are we now? You know, what chance have we got now? And I think Gerrard has suddenly realised it. I think the fans have suddenly realised it in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And you look at the fact that Chelsea could buy two really good strikers next season and become probably the favourites for the title again. This is a huge opportunity for Liverpool to win a title they never thought they could win.
Yeah.
And they might not have it again for a few more seasons. It might still be up there, but I think not with this kind of opportunity.
All right, well, I mentioned fleetingly Man City's 4-1 victory over Southampton, which did feature a pretty colossal refereeing error on the goal that put City ahead in that match. But as Southampton's players themselves were saying, that the bigger issue was poor Jay Rodriguez. Is there any further word now on how his knee is?
I haven't heard, but it doesn't look good, right. Does it? I mean,
cruciate ligaments. And
even if he's done his medial ligaments, I mean, that kind of injury to like 8 weeks or something. I don't know why I looked at my watch then, as if my watch is going to tell me the medial
ligaments. Do you have a hand for
ligament injuries? Yeah, this new injury watch I've got, yeah. It says 8 weeks there for medial ligaments. So.
Right.
But if it's his cruciate then, I mean, obviously he's got no chance.
Yeah. But even without, planes, Brazil, etc.
Yeah, and he was a player who, you know, was debatable whether he'd go anyway, so...
Mm.
Yeah, Pochettino, after the game, he spoke English and sort of gave an insight into why he hasn't been speaking it before, because he came out with this most nonsensical argument about why City shouldn't be awarded a penalty by saying that it was too early in the game for the ref to be awarding penalties.
You know, right.
Basically, anything that happens the first 10 minutes, fair game.
Right.
And then after that, you can award a penalty.
I think I see his point. First 10 minutes, always difficult. Listeners of this particular podcast will no doubt appreciate. But having got into our game, part two awaits when, Rafa, you're going to tell us all about Man United at Bayern Munich, eh? Man United at Bayern. Here's Girondist NYC. Rafa was wrong, dead wrong. None of Wagner, the original Teutonic pagan myth cycles, or the 19th century reimaginings of same the work is based on are related to pre-Justinian ancient Rome or Greece. And thus the reference to Götterdämmerung wasn't classical. Stereotyped, cliched and uncalled for, but not classical. So that's put you right then.
Well, I have to disagree respectfully with this listener, because in German when you say classic, it refers to all classic music, opera, etc. So when I say...
Well, how do you define classic then?
So I just did.
When's your cutoff? It refers to all, what, music? Or
classical
what?
Music.
But what is classical music? When you say classic, it refers to classical music. What, how do you define classical?
I was going
to
say in Germany, probably.
There's
is
nothing
like,
more classic than the Scorpion.
I suppose it's music composed before the 20th century.
Music that's not plugged in.
Yeah. With
Pre-20th century, that's
orchestra.
Classical.
Yeah. Well, that kind of stuff.
I caught you on a weak point there. It's a little bit fuzzy.
99 red balloons.
Yeah, there you go. There's another one. So that was electronic. Kraftwerk. Have some of that.
Well, anyway. I think you could argue that Kraftwerk is classic.
Absolutely.
Classical.
Could you argue it? I'm not sure.
I personally couldn't argue it.
But
very
I'm not sure if you should take it beyond.
I'd like to call in an expert to argue it on my behalf.
Yeah,
someone
might
who's
be
more
argued.
Knowledgeable than I could argue it.
Excellent. Anyway, now, Man United's coming off a classic performance, he said, segueing neatly along there. They won 4-0, you probably saw it, at St James's Park against the ever-excellent Newcastle, who scored none, conceded 11 in their last three. But what does this mean? What does this mean then, Rafa? Ahead of their visit to the Allianz Arena, where they'll be facing a Bayern team that hasn't won in two games?
Three.
Three games. And has just lost for the first time in 54 matches.
Pep out.
Yeah.
I'd say. Yeah, I mean, I don't think the 4-0 win against Newcastle means anything. I think it brought a bit of normalcy to the job. I think Levert Moyes probably had a sense of what it is or should be like to be Man United manager. You've got Champions League games, you change a lot of players, you turn up against an opposition who are on the beach and you have an easy 4-0 win and everyone's happy.
Mm.
That's how it should be. The fact that it hasn't been this season, that it is almost seen as something that's worth talking about, shows you where the season has been. Now, I think they're in a very good position because they're coming off this almost as if they've already won half of the tie, because they were written off. People said they would have no chance, to be absolutely destroyed. The fact that they got a 1-1 draw and now have a real chance, it might be a small one, but it is a very genuine chance to knock out Bayern, maybe in a score draw or sneak an away win. It's not impossible in a Champions League at this level. Moyes is already, as strange as it sounds, there's almost a sense he's always overachieved already in this tie, which is a very great position to be in. All the pressure is on Bayern, because they know if they get knocked out, then the season will end on a very sour note. The fact that they won it in record time domestically is great, but also only made it more important in a way to succeed in Europe for a second time. And yeah, I think Bayern can be rattled, and if United defend as well as they did and take their chances on the counter, it could be a very close call.
So are you expecting Man United to adopt much the same game plan as last time? And if so, how confident are you that Bayern are going to be more effective in breaking them down?
Well, it comes down to very little things. I mean, they broke through two or three times and then the cross wasn't right. You know, if the run is a little bit different from the centre forward, I think Müller isn't quite as good as finding these runs inside the box as a genuine centre forward like Mario Mandzukic is. I think he'll play. And if Bayern just a little bit sharper in transition and just get their game plan better on the pitch, and I think there's every chance they'll win. Having said that, you know, Champions League is about one or two goals, is about refereeing decisions going your way. I think the margins are quite small, and that's why this talk about Bayern sort of completely destroying United, I think, was always optimistic from a Bayern point of view and far too pessimistic for
Do you think it might United. Be more difficult for Guardiola looking at a David Moyes Manchester United than perhaps even an Alex Ferguson one, in that there's an element of the unexpected, because even David Moyes hasn't been sure what to do with his team at times this season?
Well, interesting enough, I mean, when you talk to the players, the Bayern players, after the game at Old Trafford, they all said that's exactly how we expected them to be. We knew there would be a counter-attacking side. That's what we prepared for. So it wasn't a surprise to them, or at least they said it wasn't. Also, when United played against Barcelona in the group stage in, I think it was 08, they played a similar game. They weren't quite as negative, but it was very, very pragmatic, shall we say, approach from Ferguson. I think the difference is that I didn't think that this team was necessarily able to soak up this much pressure with the problems that they've had at the back. And I think Bayern missed the trick by not really testing them more, with having more genuine strikers really giving them trouble. They tried to play their similar way, which is sort of to play through them from wide areas, and it was fairly easy in the end for United to shut them down.
No Schweinsteiger. One or two other absences as well.
Martinez is suspended as well.
And Thiago Alcantara.
Thiago is injured. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because a couple of weeks ago, the big debate was, you know, this squad is maybe too deep. All this rotation is terrible because it kind of breaks up the rhythm of the players. And what happens to Schweinsteiger if he's not playing? What happens to Kroos if he's not playing? And now you look around and actually there isn't that much depth at the moment. So Lahm again will play in midfield. Kroos will play next to him. And then you'll probably have to change the formation slightly to have a genuine number 10 in either Müller or Götze. And then the wide players as usual, and then Mandzukic up front. So I think Bayern, the whole game will change if Bayern score first, because then United will have to open up a little bit more, and then Bayern can, I think, settle more on the ball and probably force the way into the direction that they want to go in. But I think it'll be nervy, and I think United will feel that the crowd might get a little bit antsy. And it was interesting that both sides, both Manuel Neuer before the game and after the game, and Phil Jones was referencing Chelsea's win in 2012. Where they said, you know, you could see that without possession, sometimes you can win games, and it becomes very, very difficult for the opposition team.
Well, we mentioned the fact that they lost for the first time in over a year. Augsburg, the team, who are having their record Bundesliga season, Augsburg. Mm. Yeah,
it's only the third, but still, it is
still the best
amazing
one they've had.
Season, yeah,
yeah. Wow, good stuff. They hadn't won at home in four, but they did it against Bayern Munich, who made major changes ahead of that game. Right, let's talk about Chelsea then, because they've got Paris Saint-Germain visiting Stamford Bridge. Chelsea, who recently entertained their chum Stoke, and they looked very impressive, didn't they? Barry, 3-0.
Yeah, it was a routine win in a match which I expected them to possibly struggle in and possibly even lose. I thought Stoke would put up a better show, to be honest, after the recent run of good form, but they were
brushed aside. Chelsea were all over them.
Just a ritual swatting.
Mm.
And Chelsea obviously have it all to do against PSG. They've got the 2-goal deficit, but a 2-0 win would get them through, and there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't do that. They've no Ramirez, which is, I think, going to be a huge loss for them, particularly as Matic can't play. But PSG are missing Zlatan,
which may or may not be a disadvantage. Talk about that in a second, but it's worth pointing out that this has twice happened before, that a team has lost 3-1 away in the first leg and gone through with a 2-0 win. In both occasions, Chelsea have been involved. One was against Barcelona years ago, back in 2000. The other time was against Napoli 2 years ago, when they lost 3-1 at the San Paolo and turned it around. James Horncastle keeps saying how PSG got much better defensive unit, though, than that Napoli side had, which is certainly true. And Lavezzi and Cavani of PSG were both in that Napoli side, and they both say there's no way. They see this as their chance for revenge. They've won the last 11 games in all competitions, Paris Saint-Germain. And this Ibrahimovic question, I mean, he did not shine in the first leg, and Cavani is allowed to play centrally when Ibra's not around. So I'm not sure if it is a disadvantage.
No, I don't think it is either, though. It should be said, I remember that Napoli game really well, and they missed so many chances, Napoli. And in the end, it was entirely entirely avoidable, that defeat. But you know, Chelsea can develop this kind of sense of urgency at home and a sense of unstoppable force at times, which makes it difficult for the opposition, even if the opposition are technically slightly better or have a good setup. So I think it'll be difficult. The one thing you can say is that one goal will probably end this tie if PSG score it. And the way that they're set up, it's hard to see them not scoring.
Chelsea at home, they were a different proposition than away from home in terms of, you know, the record they've got and the way he's drilled the defence this season. I think if Chelsea have got a chance of going through, it's going to come down probably to Willian and Hazard, in terms of they'd be the players who can get in between the lines and find that space, which PSG haven't allowed a lot of teams this season, but I think they're going to be key players.
Mm. Well, as you mentioned, their record at home defensively, they haven't conceded there in their last 8 matches. So, yeah, it's going to be a tight one, that. Tied. What do you think, Barry?
I think PSG will score, and after that, can Chelsea do enough to get past them? Probably not.
Mm. All right. Okay. But the other quarterfinals, you've got Borussia Dortmund hosting Real Madrid. Real 3-0 up from the first leg, but Lewandowski's back from suspension. Mm. Is it enough, Rafa?
I don't think it is. Dortmund are trying to convince themselves that they might just be able to pull it off, but I don't think they believe it. And I don't think they believe that they can convince themselves into believing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the problem is not so much beating Real Madrid. The problem is that if Real Madrid score, and it's hard not to see them scoring against a defence that has been very vulnerable, then Dortmund need 5 goals. I'd love to say I think they might have a chance, but I just don't see it.
Also, everyone goes on about the Signal Iduna Park and that, but there was this weekend the first time that they'd had a home win against the top half of the table side from the Bundesliga, which I know is a little bit of a complicated way of saying it, but basically they've not had a good record at home against top German sides, so by extension Real Madrid.
Yeah, I mean, look, they drew 0-0 with Schalke a couple of weeks ago, a game where they should have beat them. They were very, very good, and I think the sample is a bit small to draw too many conclusions from that. What I would say is that the problem for them is that their style is so intense and so high risk. First of all, when you do create chances, you cannot afford to miss them, because you're not playing in a way that allows you to settle and to slowly carve out position. You create a chance quick, and you need to take it because you might not take have the ball or create another chance at that in the next 15, 20 minutes. That's one thing, one problem that they had. And at the back, if you play a really high line, if you press, if you push, you'll get into lots of 1v1 duels. And if you're not on your game, or if individually you have problems, which they have, you'll lose these battles. And that's what happened against Real Madrid. They created a lot of chances, Dortmund, relatively. They had quite a lot of the ball. They looked good in patches, certainly in the second half. But every time Real Madrid got into the final third, they looked like scoring, whereas Dortmund were terribly wasteful. And I think they've blown this one, and I think they know.
Right. The other German news from the weekend, Sami Hyypiä out of Bayer Leverkusen.
It's quite sad, this. I mean, Rudi Völler was saying, the sporting director was saying two things. First of all, he said, "I'm really sorry. We had no other choice." And then yesterday, after thinking hard and deep about this, he said, "Well, we had to fire him because of refereeing mistakes," which I don't think was really that convincing an argument. It's a shame because he started so well. He looked like he could be a manager that was on a steep learning curve, but making all the right moves and trying to establish himself in the Bundesliga and then possibly go on and get another bigger job. But unfortunately, I think his temperament is such that when things didn't go according to plan, he did not have the right motivational tools.
He's always been a very placid character.
So. Incredibly flat. And Leverkusen are a side that always need to be rattled and shaken up a little bit, because you have players there who are very good but are only at that club for the money, or because they hope to go to somewhere else afterwards, because the club itself is fairly small and doesn't have a big emotional pool. And unless you have a manager who can somehow overcome that, like Christoph Daum, who was a maniac but had the touch, it's very, very difficult to find success with them.
Right, well, they're now outside the top four for the first time in 17 months. Kind of Arsenal-esque.
Yes. Yeah,
ish. Anyway, the other quarterfinal on Wednesday, I'm thinking, is Atletico-Barcelona. What a duel those two are having, because they got this, and then they're first and second in the Liga as well. Impossible to call, I would say, Barry.
Well, they've played four times this season, four draws, 3-1-1 draws.
Oh, it's quite easy to call then, isn't it? It's a 1-1 draw.
I think it is. It's going to be a draw. personally, I'd like to see Atletico go through.
So they can beat Real in the final?
Oh, well, wouldn't that be a sensational final to have?
Unless you're a Real Madrid fan. But yeah.
Well,
it would be Atletico's first final appearance in 40 years.
No. Since 1974.
Yes.
Who are they against?
A team from Bavaria.
Really?
Who beat them in the replay.
Ooh, they had a replay, the final?
They had a replay in the final. Allegedly, because Pepe Reina's dad, who was in goal for Atletico that night, was already discussing with a photographer behind him whether he will give him his kit after the game or not. And then the last minute of the game, Schwarzenbeck, who never scored any goals, came up and in sheer desperation scored from 30 yards.
Because Pepe Reina was talking to the photographer behind the goal.
Pepe Reina's dad. He's always denied it. He's always denied it. But that is the story. And then there was a replay, and then Bayern won it comfortably.
Brilliant. All right. Leicester. It's 10 years since they've been up in the... Maybe it's 11. But anyway, it's a decade since they've been up in the Premier League. But they're back. Boom. Without kicking a ball. Greg Bukowski.
Well, they did kick a ball on Friday night. They kicked it twice into Sheffield Wednesday.
But that didn't get the promotion, did they?
No, it didn't. QPR not beating Bournemouth, and they had a chance to because Bournemouth went down to 10 men, and also Derby getting beat, opened the door for Leicester into the Premier League. And it's funny with Leicester. I mean, they had Nigel Pearson as manager. It was like the trusty old wife, you know, at home, the local lass, you know. And then they got a bit bored and went off with these sexy Europeans for a bit, and it didn't work out. Came back sobbing to the trusty old lass, and trusty old lass has worked out for them.
Is there a lesson in that for us, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I don't know quite what it is.
I think you do, Greg. Yeah, I think you do.
Maybe, yeah. Hope my wife's not listening.
I really hope she is.
Anyway, Leicester have gone up into the Premier League, yeah. And that's a good thing. They played the best football in the Championship.
In the dramatic time.
Yeah, yeah.
I think better the devil you know is the lesson.
All right, okay. The Italians have a phrase, a cow and wife from your own hometown.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I should have just said that, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'd rather take my chance.
Didn't you tell me the same saying was saying don't have a cow and wife?
No, no. It is, they say, I'm going to pronounce this really badly, but it's moglie buio dal paese tuo. Yeah, you know, like get your beef and your missus from your from where you can trust them. Well, well done to Leicester. I look forward to seeing them in action in the Premier League next year. But in place of whom? That's the question we're going to be looking at in part three. Yes, it's that relegation battle. Wow. All bets are off, I'm going to suggest. All bets are off. Today, Spurs are hosting Sunderland. That game will have been played by the time a lot of people hear this. So maybe we shouldn't go too far in our predictions. But
well, should we talk about the G?
Well, exactly. The biggest result Sunderland have had of late is surely the fact that they didn't get deducted points. This for the use of... What's his full name, Barry?
Ji Dong Won.
Right. In five games, and yes. They've not been docked points. Or Toon Toon, for example, suggesting that the punishment for Sunderland for breaking the rules should be being forced to play G in their remaining games. Quite a neat little...
Well, G is currently at Augsburg and on his way to Borussia Dortmund after that.
Oh, that would be difficult then, logistically speaking.
Four of the games he played in were Premier League games from which Sunderland won 1 point.
1 point.
I'd have no complaints if they were docked that point. I mean... They broke the rules, and other teams have been docked points.
But not in the Premier League.
Similar-ish.
West Ham weren't docked points over the Tevez affair.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's registered at the time. He was a registered Sunderland player. He had received international clearance previously, so it was a very minor clerical error, a clerical error nonetheless. And where I'm uncomfortable with this is why. Sunderland and the Premier League felt the need to hush this up. So, you know, perhaps it was just, oh, we don't want a fuss or whatever. I think if Sunderland, in the very unlikely event that Sunderland stay up, I think anyone who goes down at their expense would be entitled to feel aggrieved. And Gus Poyet has said, and I'd be inclined to agree with him, that I'd have no objections if they were... Dock point.
Well, he was involved in a similar situation on the other side of it when he was at Brighton.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there you go. Sunderland currently bottom of the table.
The situation with that he was involved in wasn't even remotely identical because the player in question who played was suspended,
right,
or should have been suspended. Whereas G is a Sunderland player registered with Sunderland, and it was just a very minor. Low-level clerical errors.
Well, in that case, it seems fair they don't get dock points for it, Barry.
Well, they haven't been.
Right.
But if they were, I wouldn't object.
Good. Sorted.
And I honestly don't think it's going to make any difference anyway.
Right.
I wonder if the Premier League acquiesced in this mistake because they probably should have worked it out after a few weeks that there was something wrong themselves.
Mm. Anyway, I don't know. Let's move on from the paperwork side of things to... The other, because we don't know where, but Sunderland at the bottom of the table right now, but who knows what's going to happen at Spurs Monday evening. Let's talk instead about Norwich, who just got a loss 1-0 at home against West Brom, and they've just fired Chris Hughton, and they've just brought in Neil Adams, who's fresh from winning the League Youth Cup. That's very good. And as a reward, he gets a run-in that goes Norwich's main direct rivals in the relegation battle away from home. That's Fulham. Then Liverpool, who are chasing the title. Man United, Chelsea and Arsenal. Bang.
But he's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
Well, his win record, as nice as he is with Norwich, is 25%. And there's a girl who works at TalkSport on our show who's
what's
a Norwich fan. Her name is Mel.
Okay.
Who's very good at football, apparently.
Right, okay.
And should possibly be playing for... But she's a season ticket holder at Norwich. And she and I think a lot of Norwich fans won't be sorry to see the back of Chris Hughton.
Yeah.
And isn't that why they sacked him now? Because he had things thrown at him and the fans obviously weren't happy about it. And I think the board have thought, well, this is going to be a popular decision if we make it now. Whereas I'd make it at another time, and it makes it more difficult for them, perhaps, if they have a decent result again. I still find it very strange that, I mean, Houghton can't get Norwich to score. I mean, we were talking before about what is Houghton's football. Nobody seems to know what it is. You know, does he even get his teams well organised, perhaps? But they're not going to survive by beating the teams here other than Fulham. I don't know why they didn't keep him in charge at least for the Fulham match, and then, you know, make a decision afterwards. And this fellow they brought in, this was the fellow who Glenn Rhoda said he's never going to be able to manage anything better than an under-10 team.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's right. I don't know whether Norwich better.
Well, he's just won, as I say, the Youth League Cup with the Norwich's under-18, so...
But that seems like he's a long-term manager, isn't he, then? He's not going to be...
I don't know.
I wouldn't have thought he's the man you're going to bring in to rally the troops for the last five games.
I don't know. The whole issue of April sackings, though, and timing, Duncan Alexander saying April sackings are super niche. Think the last one, I don't know if this is true, was Chris Coleman at Fulham in 2007. Before that, Tigana also at Fulham. So it doesn't happen very often in the Premier League.
But Houghton has now fallen victim to the curse of being beaten by West Brom and then getting sacked for the second time.
Wow.
It happened to him at Newcastle. It's now happened to him at Norwich. AVB, Mick McCarthy, Paolo Di Canio, Mancini and Roberto Di Matteo are also managers who've lost their jobs after being beaten by West Brom. So being beaten by West Brom seems to be, you know, the absolute depths you could plumb.
Right. It's the bed next to the door, isn't it, in the hospital ward.
Normally, the youth coaches play the same kind of tactics as the, you know, the same formation as the senior teams.
Unless they're Tim Sherwood.
Well, yeah, unless you're Tim Sherwood. And it'd be interesting if this fellow actually does that. Maybe he doesn't, and that's why they brought him in, because he can, you know, change things and do some tinkering. And
I mean, sometimes change is needed simply on a human level.
Right. What are you saying, Rafa?
Where the relationship between the big Supremo and the underlings is just so fraught.
Some people thrive on that kind of thing. People like topicalities. Massimo Cellino, because April sackings may be rare in the Premier League, but they certainly ain't in Serie A, where Cellino was busy again sacking Diego Lopez, Cagliari manager, after 9 months, and bringing back the man who used to be his assistant, who he fired himself a short time before. Cellino is now on his 37th Cagliari boss in 22 years, but some of those have been there repeatedly, so, you know, figures are actually even worse than that. The other guy who went this weekend was Rolando Maran, down at Catania, and if that sounds familiar, it's because, yes, he's already been fired by Catania once this season. So,
some crazy Italians.
I'll tell you what.
It's going to be stability at least.
Speaking of Italians, Tancredi Palmieri posting in with an interesting ranking of managers sacked so far. Get this. A Serie A 13 managers binned this season. In second place, the Premier League with 9. In third place, the Bundesliga with 7. And then fourth equal, it's the Liga and Ligue 1 with 6. What do you make of that, Rafa?
I'm quite surprised, because my sense is, without having the facts at hand, is that the Bundesliga used to be a bit more trigger-happy than the Premier League in the past years.
Really?
Absolutely. Because you'll never hear in the Bundesliga, the manager should have given more time, you know, give him 2 more years. Things that used to hear all the time, the manager would come in and say, well, he'll need 3 or 4 years to sort the side out.
Mm.
Nobody ever bought that in Germany.
Has the Premier League, has the rate of dismissals and firings gone up since the influx of foreign managers, where there's less, maybe there's less personal ties between the club and the personnel?
Possibly, but I'd say you just look at the league in the Premier League this season. The points gap has been so tight between mid-table and relegation that I think that's been maybe the reason why the owners have thought, well, hang on, this is, you know, maybe it's the chance here. When we're not cut adrift yet, we can make a change and perhaps end up finishing mid-table. I think it's actually been how tight it's been between 10th and the bottom of the table that's caused it this season.
Right. Well, extraordinary figures when you look at the kind of league table of how long managers have been in. And we mentioned Wenger before. He's been there for absolutely ages. But, for example, David Moyes is 10th in the longevity stakes.
Rodgers is 4th, I think, isn't
Rodgers
he,
is 4th.
Yeah.
Gus Poyet is 13th. And he only came in halfway through the season. Incredible. Jonathan Wilson saying, mind you, we're still not like Argentina, where Juan José Pizzuti at 52 months is the longest serving Rathing manager ever. 52 months, longest serving they've ever had. It's incredible.
Massimo Cellino as well, he's had his...
Boy, that's a confusing one, isn't it? Well, so they've given him the okay, but pending actually finding out why the Italian courts have this weird thing of they publish a verdict, but they don't actually give you the explanation for it for months afterwards. And so, were you about to say this, that the fit and proper persons board have said, well, we'll give him the okay until we find out if he's been dishonest or not?
Yes, which seems a bit weird because assuming he goes ahead and buys the club, if they then discover that he has been dishonest, which the verdict from Italy would suggest might be the case, what happens then?
Yeah.
I noticed also today that Gianfranco Zola has been linked with Brian McDermott's job as manager of Leeds, and I was just wondering, is that because of his Cagliari collection, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I would imagine that would... He certainly doesn't have any Leeds connection that I can think of, but he did play at the end of his career when he went back to Cagliari and took them up and then played one final season before hanging up his wee boots. What does he say, Greg? Firing a manager and maybe finishing up in mid-table. Crystal Palace could do that. They've moved all the way up to 14th now, courtesy of that 3-0 win over Cardiff, who look well and truly gone there, don't they?
Yeah, but Solskjaer just looked completely deflated at the end, and I think he realises now there's not much more he can do, I don't think, to motivate them, which is a sad state of affairs, really, there.
Mm. Right. And let's finish off by talking about, boom, Hull got a 1-0 win against Swansea, but which kind of moves them out of what danger they were still in. But let's finish off by talking about Fulham. Now, going into this weekend, a lot of people thought that's it for Fulham, they're gone. But it was exactly the same situation as in 2008 when they stayed up under Roy Hodgson, you recall, when they got four wins in their final six and final day, yada, yada, yada. Well, this weekend then they got their first win out of those six. Admittedly, it was Villa at Villa Park, which is a bit rubbish, and they had no Benteke because he was out injured. But what do you think, Barry? Is it on, the great escape?
Well, I suggested in the weekend preview that we had up, myself and Paul Doyle wrote between us on Friday, that if Fulham could beat Villa, their running is quite kind in that they're either playing teams with nothing to play for or teams with everything to play for, teams around them, fellow relegation strugglers. They might just do it.
They need three wins from, well, Norwich, Hull, Stoke, Crystal Palace and Spurs. Crystal Palace, the last day of the season.
They're all winnable games.
Mm.
Hull will be focused on the FA Cup semi-final. Now, they may be out of it by then, or they may be in the final, depending on how their semi goes. And the rest, you know, Norwich, beatable, Swansea, they're all winnable games.
Mm. It's remarkable, isn't it? Remarkable.
And McGath has form in getting teams out of pickles like this, as Raphael has told us before.
He has, and the way it's set up, I think it's more or less a straight race between them and Norwich, and they have vastly inferior goal difference, so they need 6 points more than Norwich from those last five games. Of course, one of them is against Norwich, and if you look at Norwich's fixtures, with Liverpool, United, Chelsea and Arsenal, can Fulham find three more points, assuming that they beat Norwich? Probably yes.
I'm quite excited for Fulham, also because Maggot looks such a cuddly character in his comedy spectacles.
It's amazing because he's come here and he's reinvented himself and said, I always like to build teams, I always like to bring in young players. I mean, it's complete nonsense, but it plays well. And, you know, if he keeps them up, then he's doing his job. So can't fault him for that.
You certainly can't. Why are you saying that? Rafa, producer Ben, was busy checking the figures, and he's noticed that, yeah, it's 15 is the difference in their goal difference, Norwich and Fulham, but when you look at the fixtures that Norwich have got, they could easily ship 15 goals in those against Liverpool, Man United, Chelsea and Arsenal.
15 is a lot.
Well, Suarez generally scores about 12 goals against Norwich.
Yeah, that's true. Right, that's another exciting Football Weekly. Next weekend's going to be amazing, isn't it? Because you've got Fulham, Norwich, and you've got Liverpool, Man City.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two crunch games at either end of the table, right there. And midweeks can be amazing too. In fact, every day is amazing in football land. Hurrah! Excellent. We're going to take a little break from all of that. We'll be back on Thursday. Many thanks to Greg and Rafa and Barry and producer Ben for being with us today. Hope it all made sense to you, listeners. And we'll be back on Thursday. Have a nice time till then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.